This podcast is sponsored by FATT, F-A-T-T, a range of keto on-the-go snacks, including cookies, brownies, chocolate bites, bars, Fat Jacks, and muffins. FATT snacks are delicious, natural, and always free from sweeteners, fillers, and seed oils. Find FATT snacks at www.livefatt.com. That's LIVEFATT.com. Use the code FABULOUSLY10, that's 10, to give an extra 10% off one-time purchases, not valid on subscribe and save. Support the Fabulously Keto podcast and join me in my mission to bring the knowledge of health and well-being to the world so that men and women can make many meaningful changes in their lives. Every podcast episode gives people the chance to learn and improve their health, and I want to be able to continuously deliver fabulous content. Each episode needs resources, inviting and coordinating with our generous guests, conducting and recording inspiring interviews, bringing you fully edited interviews, crafting episode artwork, engaging our audience through social media content, including visuals, content, and audio clips, sharing across various social media platforms, ensuring our dedicated subscribers receive timely newsletters. Your support is pivotal in sustaining the Fabulously Keto podcast. Whether through a one-time contribution or a recurring monthly pledge, start from as little as $1 or £1. Every bit counts. I understand our community spans the globe, and for this reason, I offer payment options in both US dollars or British pounds. Whilst we do have a sponsor for the podcast, that goes only partway to covering some of the costs, and I'm really grateful to FATT for their assistance and their support. There are additional costs, including my time investment, which still have to be covered by me. Your support bridges this gap and ensures that I can continue to deliver premium content without compromise. To see the ways that you can support us, go to fabulouslyketo.com/podcast. But I'd really like to take a few seconds to tell you about our Super Fabulously Keto supporter option. This costs £10 or $12.50 a month. And as a Super Fabulously Keto supporter, you'll get your name mentioned at the top of the show. You'll get access to the podcast before it's released for general listening with reduced intros and outro messages. You'll be part of a private Facebook group exclusively for Super Fabulously Keto supporters, where you can share with other members and make friends. And you'll be invited to our monthly group Zoom calls with me, where we'll discuss topics, answer questions, and hold each other accountable to goals. Topics will cover real food, low carb, intermittent fasting, extended fasting, keto, and carnivore. You'll be able to try different protocols to move the needle on your journey. So that is available also from our Fabulously Keto page, support. So that's fabulouslyketo.com/support. I really appreciate any support you can give.
Welcome to the Fabulously Keto podcast, aimed at improving health, vitality, and quality of life. Eating real food in a ketogenic lifestyle. I'm Jackie Fletcher, and I'm based in the UK.
And I'm Louise Reynolds, an Aussie currently based in Bangkok, Thailand.
Each week, we will be bringing you guests who share their stories and discuss a range of topics which we hope will improve your health and well-being.
Many of the guests, like us, came to keto for weight loss and have stayed for their well-being, numerous health benefits, and because they are living their best lives. We hope you will be inspired to incorporate these ideas into your own health journey so that you can feel better than you ever have before.
Thinking about starting keto? Take a listen to episode number 2, What is Keto and How to Start?
Welcome to episode 185 of the Fabulously Keto podcast. And today I'm interviewing Kent Bray. Kent Bray isn't on a keto, low-carb, or even real food way of eating. A mutual friend of ours and one of our podcast listeners and Facebook group members, Karina Lewis, mentioned to me that Kent wanted to get on some podcasts. I spoke to Kent and thought he has a really powerful story of overcoming addiction. I put a poll in the Facebook group and 20 people responded and 20 people said, yes, get him on. So here is Kent. Let me tell you a bit about him. Kent Bray says, I was raised in Rockhampton, Queensland, Australia. I left school and obtained a law degree. During this time, I played for Australia under 21s in rugby. I practiced law for 18 months. It wasn't for me. I then got a scholarship to Oxford University. I played in the varsity matches. I played and coached at Harlequins Rugby Club in London. I then had a 22-year career in the City in London, spending 18 years at Citibank and rising to the level of director. I semi-retired just prior to my 50th birthday. I entered a rehabilitation centre 2 years later in 2016, weighing 10 stone. I was a raging cocaine addict. I'm now approaching 8 years clean and sober. I'm currently a healthy 14 and a half stone and a present and available dad to my two children. I am now a therapeutic counsellor and mentor. I'm eternally grateful to be alive and to be living. So let's go and hear Kent's powerful story.
Welcome, Kent, to the Fabulously Keto podcast. It's fabulous to have you with us today.
Thank you, Jackie. It's lovely to be here.
And I always start with, where in the world are you?
So I'm in a place called Ramsden Bell House, which is just outside Billericay in Essex.
Excellent. Now, we were just talking off air and I was saying how we were in a meeting and I remembered you, but you were just visiting in a sea of faces of 50 people, but we have met, sort of.
That's correct. That is it.
So, and hopefully our paths will cross again.
For sure.
So you were put in touch with me because you were wanting to get on podcasts, and actually your story, background, lifestyle isn't our normal run-of-the-mill podcasts.
Yeah.
But when we spoke, your story was really interesting and really powerful, and I asked our Fabulously Keto Facebook group if they would be interested in hearing from you, and we had 20 people say yes and nobody say no. So I'm sure that listeners are going to find this very interesting, even though it's not about diet and nutrition, it's not about health, although it is a bit about health. It definitely is mental health and physical health. But it's just different to what we normally do. So that's going to be very exciting.
Yeah, I remember we had that chat and I said to you, I said, look, I want to adhere to the sort of integrity of your podcast and the core values of it. And I said, are you sure this is the right fit? Because my story really is about it's about a sort of achievement and then, pointedly cocaine addiction and then recovery therefrom. And so I said, look, are you sure? And you said you'd get back to me. And I was a little bit surprised, actually, when you said that you put it out for 20 people and all 20 said yes. So that's reassuring because, as I said, I wanted to, adhere to the integrity of your podcast. I think that's important. But as I said, as we said offline, there's a story of my life and my addiction. And then there's the messages of experience, strength, and hope, and that's the stuff that I personally is what I want to get across, is that people can recover from all sorts of presenting issues, and mine was obviously addiction, which we'll get into. But yeah, thank you very much for those 20 people who gave me the vote of confidence, and here I am today.
Yeah, there was more than 20 in the group, but it was 20 that replied. So why don't we start with your story? Because I found that very powerful and I'd love to hear it again.
Yeah, it's a very easy story it's a very easy story to tell. Sometimes that's not the case. When I say it's an easy story to tell, It's the easy story to tell because it's my story. I've only got one story. It's not easy at parts. I'll be very honest. Every time I tell this story, I get emotionally moved only because of the places that it takes me. And that takes me back to some, you know, some painful areas of my past. But we'll start from the beginning. And this will be pretty much a whistle-stop tour of my life. So obviously I'm an Australian and I grew up in a place called Rockhampton, which is in central Queensland. And look, whatever visions you got in your head about growing up in Queensland country, it's probably pretty much true. It was just, you know, it's hot. You know, there was, you know, there's a lot of land and a lot of my friends were on big farms and my upbringing was pretty good. You know, I was the youngest of three boys. There wasn't a lot of money. Mum and dad worked very, very hard. I think it was that generation where there was a, I don't know if it was over here, but certainly in Australia it was like, we are going to give our kids the education we didn't have. So a lot of the money that went into that household went directly into the education of me and my two brothers, and we went to private school, like secondary school. So I was very good at sport, and I don't say that for ego. I just say it was a fact. I was very, very good at sport. I was okay in the classroom. I didn't drink or drug to feel part of or anything like that. I was part of. And I, you know, I was good at school. I had a, the one thing I will say about my childhood, I lost a brother when I was 16. And we may talk about that later. But that had a profound effect on my life at that time because I just wasn't emotionally robust to handle it. So he passed away when I was 16. I left school. I did law. I became a fully qualified lawyer in Australia. And at that time, the sport I loved was rugby. So I threw myself into rugby. I played for Australia under 21s, played provincial rugby, did a fair bit of touring. And then I studied law, became a lawyer, and I hated it. I didn't like studying it. And I didn't like practicing it. I only practiced law for 18 months. And I realised I only did it to people please my parents and thank them. I saw a varsity match on TV between Oxford and Cambridge. I applied to Oxford, got a scholarship to Oxford University, and I was there and I studied. I did a postgrad diploma, played in the varsity match. Then I worked out I wasn't going to play for Australia, got a job in the city, played for Harlequins over here, player and coach. I was there for 6 years. 22 years in the city, 18 years at Citibank, and I semi-retired 10 years ago just prior to my 50th birthday, so it sounds like a pretty good story. I had one major problem, and that was I was a absolutely raging, ravenous cocaine user. And I did mention some amounts and monetary sort of stuff to you. So I was, for those that know a little bit about cocaine, I ended up doing about 20 to 30 grams of cocaine a week. On the bad days, it was 6 grams a day. I was doing 80,000 pounds a year. And I was in a, I wasn't in a great state physically or mentally. I checked into a rehab. On the 6th of April 2016, and I was, so today I'm 14 and a half stone. I checked into this rehab under 10 stone, and the reason I was under 10 stone was because I was doing so much cocaine I wasn't eating. And obviously the effect of not eating was not only the losing of the weight, but I just looked absolutely terrible. And mentally I was very fragile. Very angry, resentful, paranoid. And I remember, this is where it starts getting a bit raw. So I sat in the rehab and I was in there for 6 weeks, but the fourth day in, I remember going to my room and I was just sitting on a single bed in my room and I was just sitting on the side of the bed and next I just put my head in my hands and I just absolutely sobbed. And I sobbed like, you know, that deep, raw, emotional outlet of all sorts of things, but I was crying my eyes out, and I just couldn't effectively, it was like this. I had everything any person would ever want. I had financial security. I had properties, I had pensions, I had superannuation, I had cash, I had shares, I had two beautiful young children, and I had nothing. So I had everything and I had nothing. And I just had this absolute hole in my soul, and I was lost. And, you know, I was 52 years old and I was just basically a mess. And I just couldn't understand how it had come to this. I knew what my CV said. I knew the labels. I knew the identities I had. But the reality was, as I sat on that bed, I was nothing more than a garden variety, generic drug addict, cocaine user. And I didn't know. I saw a photograph of myself recently. I had to do a presentation. And there's this photograph of me, and I looked terrible, absolutely terrible. And I looked at it, and first of all, I had a little smile on my face. I thought, oh, my God, I still have my smile. Still have my smile on, even though I was drug addicted and in a really, really bad place. And then I felt really, really sad looking at the photograph because I thought to myself, that's all I had left. You know, physically and mentally, that's all I had left was a smile. And all that needed to happen, the last act was that had to be played out was a heart attack because of the cocaine use, the massive strain it puts on your heart, the amount I was using. I mean, I wasn't a stupid person, obviously. If you put that amount of that substance in your body that regularly, you are going to have a heart attack. And all that was left to happen to me was to have a heart attack and die. And that would have been devastating because I would have left two beautiful young children without a father. And to that day, even when I say those words right now, that hurts. That, you know, it's still raw emotionally in me because I love my children so much. Went into rehab, came out. Went into rehab, came out, sat in a hotel. 8 days later, relapsed in a hotel for 3 weeks doing absolutely ridiculous amounts of cocaine. Had what they call in Narcotics Anonymous a spiritual awakening in a hotel room. I was sitting in this hotel room, went to the toilet, 3:22 a.m. on the clock on the TV, and I just went, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I am absolutely done. And that was the 18th of June, 2016. I've not had one line of cocaine or one sip of alcohol since. Over 7.5 years clean and sober. Got offered jobs to go back to the city. Turned them down. That chapter's finished. Studied for 2.5 years. Became a therapeutic counsellor. And today I'm a counsellor, mentor, life coach, and happy, content, relaxed, the best version of a dad I can be, which means absolutely everything to me. I'm not special. I'm not different. I'm not amazing. The world does not revolve around me, and I used to think possibly it did back in the day. But, the greatest gift of my recovery is that my kids are getting the best of me, whatever the best of me is. I'm not the father of the year, but, I'm in a pretty good place. So, come up for breath. That is my story.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about how you get to that point where you're so addicted to cocaine. What's the trigger points that lead up to it?
A really good question. So I use socially, and that's not uncommon up in the city, obviously, where there's a lot of money around and young people, all the vice is going to be there. What I can identify now is that in my late 40s, I was struggling. And this is quite pointed in the sense that I was in a country I didn't want to be in, with a woman I didn't want to be with, doing a job I didn't want to do. And I was struggling. And this is my first message, is that don't do what I did. What I did was I wouldn't put my hand up. I refused to put my hand up. And the reason I refused to put my hand up was because of ego and pride. I'm a man, and I was the guy that got things done, law degree and playing for Australia, under 21 level in Oxford and up in the city. But, yeah, it was a coping mechanism, and I was, I was struggling. It was a coping mechanism, and then I was gripped with guilt, shame, remorse and embarrassment, which then meant even further I wasn't going to put my hand up.
Mm.
But life was difficult, and I struggled, and that's why. I leant into it. It went from, I call it, 1 minute the dog is wagging the tail, next minute the tail is wagging the dog. So whilst using cocaine socially and somewhere I crossed the line into addiction where I'd wake up in the morning and just my body craved. No. I'd have to do two or three lines of cocaine to take my kids to school. That's a really horrendous thing to admit to, especially in a public forum like this. But it is my truth. But I'm not that person today. And that is the important part.
Yeah. And, you know, there'll be other people out there that maybe are in that position or were in that position that it will resonate with. And, you know, I never touched drugs ever. Well, maybe smoked a bit of pot when I was 18, but not much because it made me sick. And I just was too scared. I was too scared to get addicted that it would, I'd try it and it would take over me. And I, so I've never had anything. So I'm the sort of opposite end. So yeah, I was just too scared.
Yeah, well, it takes all sorts. I mean, you know, I've learned, I cannot, you know, Jackie, I can't tell you how much I've learned in the last 7.5 years about all sorts of things. I can identify, you know, when you, there's people out there who would be like me, what I call riskers. So they'll try anything. You know, they'll try, you know, do you want a beer? Do you want this? Do you want that? Do you want some weed? Yeah, do you want some ecstasy? Do you want some ketamine? Do you want some, and they'll just try everything. I didn't try everything, but I tried, you know, I smoked weed, I did some ecstasy, and nothing grabbed me. I didn't, you know, so when I got addicted, I couldn't believe it. I just thought, I didn't think I was a druggo. And yet I had to admit that I was, yeah.
Mm. So there are people that believe that whether you're addicted to alcohol or drugs, that it actually comes from before that, where we're addicted to sugar because we're brought up with so much sugar. And probably for the last, I'm going to say 60 years at least, where mothers were encouraged to bottle feed their babies. Mm-hmm. They didn't breastfeed, so they bottle fed. And so the formula milk has a lot of sugar in it. And then that starts the addiction to sugar, and then it leads on from there. Does that resonate with you at all?
One thing that dialogue, yeah, it does, because I have got a sweet tooth. I do take too much sugar. I have too much sugar, and I have processes in recovery that I do believe that I am addicted to sugar, and I have stopped a fair bit of it, but I find that really difficult. You know, things like chocolates and, yes, sweets. So, yeah, that does resonate with me. Yeah, for sure, with the sugar addiction, absolutely.
Yeah.
I didn't know that about the formula. That's interesting, about the bottle feeding with the sugar in the formula. Yeah, I was not aware of that, yeah.
I mean, maybe back in the 60s, I know I was bottle fed, but, you know, maybe it didn't have as much sugar, but as time has gone on, they're probably adding more and more sugar to it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's highly addictive, and I definitely take too much sugar, for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. And they even put sugar in cigarettes for the addiction. So my son is going through a period now where he's trying to give up smoking. I think he's been 3 weeks or something like that. And I said, it's not the nicotine. The nicotine is out your body in 2 to 3 days. It's the habit of what you do with your hand, putting your hand to your mouth, and the sugar they put in it to keep you addicted.
Yeah, that concept of addiction, I found once I, because I didn't know about all sorts of things. So when I went to rehab, I didn't know there was a way out. I'd never heard of Narcotics Anonymous. I hadn't heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I went into rehab, knowing me the way that I knew me, I thought, I can get fiercely focused and determined on something, and which is played out in what I've achieved in my life. And I thought to myself, I am so addicted here. It was, Jack, it's very, very hard to explain to someone like yourself who's you know, never done drugs, is I was beholden to this white powder Like I would be reading stories to my daughter, you know, Peppa Pig and all that. She'd be, you know, one or two or something. And I'd be upstairs and my partner, my girlfriend would be downstairs. I could hear her downstairs and go into the pantry or something. And I'd just say to my daughter, oh, darling, I'm just going to go to the toilet. And I'd go in and just do, you know, a massive line of cocaine because I was just absolutely, you know, addicted and I had to have it in that moment sort of thing. So the concept of addiction, you're talking about your son with the cigarettes and we're talking about addiction to sugar. I cannot express the hold it had on me. I couldn't believe how powerful it was. And when I look back on now and look at the person I was, and it was all because of addiction, all because I just could not stop. People say, oh, you've got a choice. You know, people who have not been addicted, they will say, you've got a choice. I'm telling you, when I woke up in the morning and I had this physical craving through my body and this mental obsession, like to explain the mental obsession, I might be watching TV and obviously I'm a sports person, I might be watching some great game of football or something, you know, that the whole world is watching, I don't know, but, you know, like some, well, say World Cup final, not World Cup final, but, you know, a big event. And all in my head I'm going, how much cocaine have I got? You know, have I got enough? When's it going to run out? I need more. Irrespective whether it's cocaine, whether it's sugar, whether it's cigarettes, whether whatever it is, the concept of addiction is it is cunning, baffling, powerful. But my message is, but you can get on the other side of it.
Yeah.
You absolutely 100% can recover from it. But it takes courage in the first instance and bravery to put your hand up and go, I've got a problem here. And you seek help, you know, from people who are armed with the facts of recovery.
Yeah. So when you were in this depth of addiction, you had a young family partner, were they aware what was going on with you or were you hiding it? What was going on?
Okay, so the first thing is I was absolutely secretive. Like guys I worked with for 15 years, believe it or not, did not know I was doing cocaine every single day. They did not know because I was massively secretive. I didn't use with people as such. I did when I was socially using, but once I got addicted, I just wanted to use by myself. I just wanted to get as much coke as I could, be somewhere alone by myself and watch it. Do it. And so my girlfriend didn't know. I've got to say that I think that also highlighted a codependency in the sense of I think she had what she wanted, which was a big house, you're not working, there was plenty of money, you know, four-wheel drive, I'm a drive, you know, kids in private school. So it was almost like, you know, turning a blind eye, possibly, I don't know. And my kids were very, very young. Right? The only thing they allude to is photographs back in the day that I looked very, very skinny is what the words they say. They said, Dad, you look really, really skinny there.
Mm.
And I had to, I'm going off on a slight tangent here, but I will tell you because it's a bit tough, but so I had to sit down with my kids. My kids are only 14 and 11. So if you go back, I'm, you know, 7.5 years clean sober. You know, if you go back, they were like 6 and 3 or 5 and 3 when I went into rehab. And the thing about when you're a drug user is cocaine user, they didn't see anything, right? Because I was going into the toilet or whatever. So it wasn't as if I was an alcoholic where they were seeing it and smelling it and da 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 da. But I had to sit down with them last year and explain, you know, because they had a website that, you know, explains, sets out that I'm a counsellor and I've got an addictive history and all that sort of stuff. So I had to sit down with my children. That was really hard, really, really hard because as parents, you know, we're role models. We protect our children. We want to show them, you know, good values and ethics and morals. And I felt like I'd let them down really, really badly. And I had to make myself vulnerable yet again and get very honest yet again. And that was a tough one. I'll tell you something, just finish that off. I was struggling a bit telling them, and my 11-year-old daughter didn't really sort of understand what was going on. She was sort of looking at her elder brother for guidance, and he was listening. And anyway, he could still struggling a little bit, and he got up and he came around to my side. He put his arm on my shoulder. He said, "Dad, it's okay. It's okay." He said, "It's not a bad story. It's a good story. You're helping people today. It's okay." And it was like, yeah, that was moving.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. You brought tears to my eyes. So if my makeup runs. So I wanted to, and I know you want to get onto the message of hope, but before we get there, I just have another question. So you went into rehab, and then you said 8 weeks later you relapsed.
8 days.
8 days.
Yeah, so you were in rehab for 6 weeks. Rehab for 6 weeks. It cost me $15,000, and this was supposed to be the answer. You know what I mean? Like, you go into rehab, and I'm going, I was in rehab. I really like rehab. In a sense of rehab, I was in this bubble. I got away from everything. I didn't have to use. I didn't have to, you know, like all that stuff about being in a job I didn't want to be in, with a woman I didn't want to be with, being in the country I didn't want to. I could just shut everything away, and I had support. I had support. I had community. I had love. I had people who were like I sat with all these people, and although we all had different stories, we ended up in that same desperate cesspit of self-loathing and self-pity and a love-hate relationship with yourself and all that. And we could tell stories, and I felt I had my tribe. I felt I could talk to someone who understood exactly what I was going through. So I had that for 6 weeks, and then, 8 days later, I had an argument with my ex. I left the house. We had an argument. I said, "Please, please, please, do not kick me out of this house tonight. Please, please, please." Anyway, I left the house, went into a hotel room, and wiped myself out for 3 weeks on coke. Yeah.
So when you had that moment in the bathroom of, "This has got to stop. I don't want to do this anymore." What did you do at that point? Did you have to go back to rehab, or how did you get from that point forward?
Okay. So let's just talk about that point, because I think this is a really good sort of message, is that I came to a point, and that's what you said, right? So I was lying on this bed, I'd gone to the toilet, and I lay on this bed, and you know when you see in movies someone's dying, and they'll have this sort of montage in their head about how they were a baby being born, then they're an infant, then they're a child, then they're a teenager, then they're what, and their life passes before their eyes, right? I sort of had something like that, and I just remember sitting there going, "Mate, you've only got 2 choices here. You haven't got 8 choices, because I'm not unintelligent." You know what I mean? I am methodical and formulaic to some extent with the way my brain works. And I went, "Mate, you only got 2 choices. You can go back to addiction, and you know all about it, and it's horrible. It's horrible. Or you had to. I had to say to myself, you have to have trust, and you have to have faith. And you've got to go to NA, and you've got to get honest, you've got to get vulnerable." And I was scared, right? And I didn't have a choice. I had no choice, right? I did have a choice. I could have gone back to addiction. But at that point, I just had this moment of clarity, and I literally, all the air went out of my body. I totally relaxed. I let down, and I just said, "I am fucking done. I'm fucking done. I'm done. Done, done." And next day I went to an NA meeting. I did 90 meetings in 90 days, which is what they suggest. I threw myself into service, and I'd say I've done, so I'm clean and sober 7.5 years, but I had a relapse. So April to April will be 8 years. And in that 8 years, I reckon I have done 700 NA meetings. And in those first 2 or 3 years, I just threw everything at it. The last few years, it's more about going back and giving back and helping other people. So what did I do? I threw myself into recovery. What did that look like? get rid of the ego, drop the pride, get acceptance. Acceptance is, oh, that's it, my drinking and drugging days. I had to accept not drinking, which was a difficult one because as a drug addict, I actually didn't have really a problem with alcohol, but the program is abstinence. So practically speaking, was going to meeting, being around like-minded people who were clean and sober and saying, how do you get clean and sober? What do you do? But there's a real sense of comfort about community. So what I heard about, like something you said, I put it out to 22 people or 20 people.
My whole Facebook group, which is about 350 people.
Right, so that's community.
Yeah.
And that community sense around, you know, your keto podcast, around keto, around, you know, diet, health, mental health, that community, you will be helping someone. That community will be helping someone because they're like-minded people, and like-minded people can get honest with each other. So I can go to a drug addict and go, yeah, I did lines of cocaine to take my kids to school. And he goes, yeah, of course you did. Why wouldn't you? I mean, that's what we all do. You know, I didn't honour my responsibilities as a, even though that relationship failed, I cannot look back at that relationship and say I gave it my best. I gave my education, you know, my educational stuff, my best. I gave my rugby my best. I gave my job in the city my best. It got the best of me. I did not give the relationship my best. And one of the reasons I didn't do that was because, you know, I was a drug addict. So, yeah, I went to rehab. Did all these NA meetings, but I embraced concepts. I embraced vulnerability. I got comfortable with saying, this is my truth. I got comfortable with being honest and not manipulative and not lying. I got comfortable with the fact that I had a goal of being, I want to be genuine. I want to be authentic. I don't want to wear masks. I don't want to role play, and I don't want to act. I did all of that. Today, what you see is what you get. What I say to people is, and they normally laugh, I go, if you don't like bald-headed Australians, that's fine. I'm okay. I'm absolutely cool because I'm comfortable in my skin, and that's the most important thing, yeah.
And at that time, were you? You said you weren't happy in the country you were in. Were you here in the UK?
Yes. So I've been over here 30 years. Yeah.
So how comes you stayed?
Kids.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, I have acceptance. I don't get angry about it anymore. I don't get resentful about it anymore. Okay, so that brings us on to a very, very, you know, interesting, well, something I want to say is that I have two goals left in my life. You know, and the first one is to be the best father I can be to my two children. That is my number one goal. And my second goal, as coy as it might sound or whatever, is just to help people. You know, I was in the take, take, take world, and it started, this is not criticism of anybody or anything. My mum and dad put me in that private school well-intentioned. But then I went to private school, and when you're in a private school, they go, oh, yeah, you got to have a good job. You've got to be qualified, you've got to do something. So I left school and I go on this pathway of prestige and status and achievement and whatever. Well, I ended up in rehab.
Yeah.
So this time around, I'm in the giving world, and it is far, far, far more fulfilling.
Yeah. So what encouraged you or led you to train as a therapeutic counsellor?
Yeah, it was, again, someone in NA, Nick, he was a counsellor, and he said to me, mate, you've got an ability because of your background across education, across sport, and across, you know, working in the city. He said, you know, you're an intelligent person. You've got a really good story. People warm to you. You could really help people. He said, I reckon you'd make a great counsellor. My first comment was, I've got no interest in becoming a counsellor because I've got enough problems on my own without listening to other people's problems. That's what I said. And he said, mate, you don't understand counselling. He said, you've got an ability to change people's lives. He said, trust me, it is unbelievably fulfilling when it works. And I could tell you a couple of stories that have absolutely moved me to a point that I don't know if I've ever been to before. And that's been in the counselling space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell us how you're helping people now.
Okay, so I got qualified. It's very interesting how the universe works. You would know this, Jackie, is that life is strange. You send energy out into the world one way and it comes back another way. So I started out as an addiction counsellor, and 8 months later I don't think I'm counselling any addicts. Well, I'm not. People have come to me around counselling for other issues, broader range of issues, and mentoring is the one that mentoring and life coaching took me a little bit by surprise. People have read my bio and stuff on LinkedIn and Facebook and stuff on Instagram, and guys and girls and their ladies and gentlemen in their 30s and 40s have reached out to me and said, look, will you mentor me? And I said, yeah. And I said, yeah. And the mentoring probably looks like about 70% mentoring, about 30% counselling. And that 30% counselling is around everyday feelings and emotions, anxiety, imposter syndrome, not worthy, da, 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 da. But one of the things I do, which I can't tell you how much I love it, I work for Mind, the mental health charity, but yep. I volunteer. I don't get paid anything. Now, I do three or four hours a week there, and what I love about that is I get a ton of support from Mind and the other counsellors there. So the education is, you know, the education trajectory is fantastic. I learn a lot, and it exposes me to all sorts of presenting issues from clients. So I'll just share one with you, and don't worry, I spoke to this guy about it. I won't mention his name. I'll change a few of the facts, but I said, can I tell the story? And he said, yeah, go for your life. So just quickly, I'll go through it quickly. So this 17-year-old boy turns up, and his presenting issue is grief. And so I sit in this little room in Basildon, Mind, and I said, well, what's the grief about? He said, he's a 17-year-old male, right? He said, 2 years ago, just prior to my 15th birthday, I was with my boyfriend, and we were in a house sitting on a sofa. The boyfriend said he needed to go to the toilet. He went upstairs. My client said, you know, he took a while and he's thinking, and he's taking a while, I'll go up. So he goes upstairs, he opens up the door, and his boyfriend had taken a knife and had cut himself from wrist to elbow on both arms, cut through his own groin and cut through his knee. So he basically went for the main arteries, and he bled out in my client's arms. Now, my client had terror nightmares for 2 years, couldn't sleep, had become very, very angry, punching walls, had become very disruptive in the family, as you can imagine, and isolated, and et cetera, et cetera. So that is the story. So and I'll be quick. On the first of 12 allocated sessions, the first session, I said, on a scale of 0 to 10, 0 being suicidal, having suicidal ideation, and 10 being euphorically joyful, where are you? And he said, I'm 0. So then we had to go through a process about, you know, his suicidal thoughts. Cut a very, very long story short, by session 12, no nightmares, hadn't had any nightmares for a few months. He'd re-engaged with his family. He was outside with nature. He wasn't punching walls, and he was looking to, re-engage back in education and go to a college. On the 12th session, I was quite emotional. I was fighting back tears because when I was up in the city, I got paid a lot of money, a lot of money. There were some years I got paid 7 figures, right, as a director of a bank. And that fulfilled me financially and prestige and status. I can't tell you how fulfilled I felt on that 12th session when I shook his hand. And I just said to him, I said, mate, you've got the world ahead of you. You know, it's over. He has tools and skills to move forward. And at that point, I was left unbelievably grateful that, one, I didn't die. So first and foremost, I didn't die, right?
Yeah.
Secondly, I'd gotten recovery. And thirdly, I was actually spending my life in a worthy cause and not getting paid anything. So at Mind, I don't get paid anything. And I came out and I spoke to the manager of Mind in that area, and I just said to him, I said, that has just been the most amazing journey that I've been on with this. He's a boy. He's not even, he's, you know, young, 17 years old. And so when you say, how am I helping people today? I help people in all sorts of ways, like counselling, mentoring, et cetera, et cetera. But that was that demonstrates, to what it, one thing it does demonstrate, how much I've changed.
Mm.
You know what I mean? From that take guy to the giving. And when I have stories like that, I can honestly say that when my time comes to go, I've made a positive influence in some people's lives. Yeah. I couldn't have said that before. I could not have said that before. So, yeah, powerful stuff, really, really powerful stuff.
So let's talk about your message, because you said you wanted to get across a message of hope.
Yeah, experience, strength and hope. Experience, strength and hope.
Go for it.
Okay, so if you're listening out there and you've got some issues going on, you know, be brave. Be brave and seek help. Just, you know, seek help. And you said to me, I don't know if this is appropriate to bring it in about the three top tips. Do you want to bring it in now?
We were going to do them at the end, but you can do them now. Or...
Well, they sort of come in with the message. The message is, you know, like, so the question was, you know, what's my message of hope? My message of hope is, okay, as long as you don't die, you're going to be okay. That's the first message I'll say to anyone, right?
Yeah.
So what do I mean by that? When my brother died, I was 16, he was 18. You know, my father came and picked me up from a rugby thing, and which was very, very unusual. And someone said, your father's here. And I said, what? And we were preparing for a game in a couple of days' time. It was a big game. Well, it seemed like a big game for us. We were 17 years old. And he turned up and I said, I knew my brother had been ill. He'd been in and out of hospital for a couple of months, but didn't know that, you know, that he could possibly die. So anyway, my father turned up and I said, oh, and he was looking away from me over this fence. And I said, what's up? He turned around and he had my mother's glasses on, big, you know, big female glasses, you know, those big glasses. And he pulled the glasses down, his eyes were red raw and he couldn't speak. And I just had this intuitive feel. I said, it's Scott, isn't it? And he said, yeah. I said, he's dead, isn't he? And he said, yeah. And I couldn't, you know, my whole life just caved in. But getting back on point, I'm okay today. You know, 16 years old, I lost a brother. I'm okay. At 30 years old, I lost a really good mate of mine. Went in for a routine back operation, didn't come out of the hospital. Had a heart attack and, you know, on life support and went into a coma. And I was, you know, me and another guy, Peter Winterbottom, big rugby player, he and I, spoke, and his parents spoke to the doctor and decided to turn the machine off. You know, but I'm okay. You know, like we go, every single person on this planet is going to go through challenges. You know, romance, finance, whatever it might be. As long as you don't die, you will be okay. You will be okay. What will make it a lot easier, though, is if you seek help.
Mm.
Seek help and speak to somebody. So, you know, that leads me into the three top tips, which is you asked me about. These are just not exclusive, but these are three that I do really, you know, believe in, is that, you know, we're not responsible for things that happen to us in our childhood or things that, like the loss of my brother, I'm not responsible for it, but I am responsible for my own recovery. So you're not responsible for things that happen to you early in your life, but you are responsible for your own recovery. Don't blame. Don't point the finger. And I know at some stages around things like sexual abuse, whatever, that's very difficult, you know. But the fact of the matter is you need to heal and recover. We need to heal and recover because there's a life to be led. So you're not responsible for what happened to you as a child, but you are responsible for your recovery. And that basically means you've got to be brave. The brave, got to be courageous, you've got to put your hand up. It's not easy. Making yourself vulnerable and telling your own truth, like I've done to you today, it's not easy, but it then helps you and it helps others.
Yeah.
The other one
before
being,
before you go on, I was just going to say that when you said that, it was like, for me, coming from a health perspective, is, you know, you did, whatever you ate, however you treated your body up until this point when you know different, and now you have a choice, a bit like the choice you had. Do you carry on with your addiction or do you stop?
Yeah.
And we have the same choice around health, is if something is making you sick, are you going to carry on with it or do you stop? And you are responsible for your recovery. It's not down to a doctor to heal you or make you better. In fact, that's not what doctors do. They just give you pills to cover the symptoms. Yes. So do you really want to heal? Then you have to take responsibility for that, and you have to do the work, which, like you said, is not easy.
That is perfectly on point. That is absolute, and that dovetails very nicely into your world. That's exactly right. People will come to a point, whether it's you know, drug addiction, alcoholism, food addiction, you know, something going on in your life, the change resides in you. If I didn't change, I was definitely going to die. But I had to manufacture the change. I had to stand up. I had to be brave. I had to face my demons. I had to. And which leads us on to, you know, nicely onto my next top tip, is that if nothing changes, nothing changes, right? Mm-hmm. So it's that thing about, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing every single day expecting a different result, you know, that one. I actually think that saying, if nothing changes, nothing changes, is not quite 100% right. If nothing changes, things get worse.
Yeah.
That's my belief, in the sense of I was isolated. No one knew I was in rehab, you know, because no one knew that I was using. And my relationship was going, my physical health was going, my mental health was going. The way I was going to die. If I wasn't going to die, I was going to end that relationship and never see my kids again because she wouldn't allow me because I was a drug addict, which would have, you know what I mean, like, it just slowly ebbs away. If nothing changes, things get worse.
Yeah.
The other one is, and I'm going to change this, is I don't know how close we are to the end of the podcast, but there's one message I really, 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 really want to get out, and it means a lot to me.
Yeah, go
ahead. And you are worthy. You are worthy. You are worthy of recovery. You are worthy of change. You are worthy of good health. I know what it's like to feel worthless. I know what it's like to sit on a bed crying my eyes out with no hope. I didn't feel like I had a hope. I didn't feel like I had a future. I didn't feel like I had a life to lead. My self-perception, I don't self-loathing really, really feels back when I think about it, self-loathing and self-pity. Self-loathing really sits with me now when I think back how I was, not how I am today.
Yeah.
I just hated what I'd become. And I just hated drugs, and I hated what it had done to me, and I did not like the person I was. But now on the other side of it, I can say, honestly, I'm worthy of being healthy. I've put in the work. I'm worthy of what I've got today. I have moments with my children, just quickly. My son said to me not long ago, he said, a couple of years ago, I think it was still in year seven, and he said to me, he came home and he said, oh, Dad, we've got this female support teacher and she's just like you. And I said, what, a female bald-headed Australian? That's a bit unlucky. And he said, no. He said, she's really kind and caring. And I'm sitting there. You got to put this in perspective. I'm a recovering drug addict. And I've got my son, after a number of years, saying to me, you know, indirectly, you are kind and caring.
Yeah.
You know, and so my point is, if you're sitting out there and you're in a really tough space, I'm telling you, you're worthy. You are worthy. Please don't forget that. And recovery and healing is definitely possible, but you've got to get brave.
Yeah.
And seek a community of support, please.
Yeah. And they can always reach out to you, even if it's just an initial chat of how do I do that? Where do I go? You know?
Yeah, definitely.
So how do people reach you?
So I'm on LinkedIn. I have a website, Kent Bray Counseling. Right at this moment, I'm in a period of sort of change of 6 months. Probably don't have to tell you this, but you start something out, you have an idea what it's going to look like. 6-8 months later, I want to change. I thought I was going to be an addiction counsellor. The mentoring life coaching stuff has come in as well. So I'm a counsellor, mentor, life coach, really trying to get into the speaking. If I could go and speak, like do what we're doing now, as in, you know, storytell with a message, if I could do that. But reaching out to me, Kent Bray Counselling website, I'm on LinkedIn, you know, I'm on Facebook. And just something you said there is, if someone reaches out to me, if I haven't got the answer myself, I'll do everything I can to signpost someone. As I said to you, the two things is that I want to be the best dad I can to be my two children, and I just want to help people. So in answer to your question, there's a website, there's a phone number, it's all in my website, email, reach out to me, LinkedIn, I'm there, you can see some videos and this, that, the other. But I just, when I think of me back where I was, I can still get tears in my eyes about how far I'd descended and you know, less than 10 stone, mentally fragile, and a really, really, really poor version of myself and in a lot of pain. If I can help people, somebody not getting to that place, or just to give them the benefit of my knowledge of my life, if I can just help someone like that kid, the 17-year-old boy, you know, seriously, if I can have those sort of positive experiences, you know, with all the time I've got left on this earth, then that's what I want to do. So I will help anybody. I literally would help anybody.
Yeah. So, Kent, I'm sure there's probably lots of listeners listening today who are saying, food, you need to change your food. You need people to change their food, because when we change what we're eating, that supports that change even more. So maybe there's some things there for you to explore. And we spoke offline, and I'm going to send you a couple of people that you might want to look into, and around mental health and even addiction, even though that's not the route you're going down.
Yeah.
But you might come across people now with addiction.
Yeah. So just on that food
getting your thing. Getting your body in the right place helps with all the other stuff as well.
100%, 100%. And then that was something I really noticed with myself, was initially it was all about not drinking and not drugging, and you know, embrace abstinence, not drink as well. But once that stopped, it was a case of, okay, I'm not drinking, I'm not drugging. What's next? And the next thing was to get my body back in shape. So that was going to the gym, exercise, and food. And what I noticed was, just like bad leads to bad leads to bad leads to bad, which is in doing a lot of drugs, you don't sleep, you don't exercise, your sleeping patterns poor, you're very moody, so that's bad leads to bad. Good leads to good leads to good leads to good. So going to the gym, putting on weight, I found myself eating better. I found myself eating more fruit. I found myself eating more vegetables. Next minute, there was this snowball effect that I actually felt better. You know, so the initial thing was just don't pick up a drug. But years down the track now, I weigh myself every day, right? So I know what my right weight is, and I adjust my diet accordingly. My girlfriend is a vegetarian.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
So it means I eat better. It means I eat better. But, yeah, that's one area. Yeah, Jackie, there's one area about the diet that I need more education about. There's no two ways about it. And to be open-minded to change in that area, 100%.
Yeah, cool. So, Ken, is there anything else that we haven't spoken about today that you would have liked to mention or would have liked me to ask you that I haven't?
The last thing I'll say is this. It's International Women's Day.
It is, March the 8th.
And I want to put out into the universe my gratitude and thankfulness for the women who have helped shape me and have had a positive impact on my life. And, oh, God, now I'm going to cry. And I just want to recognise my mother, who passed away 7.5 years ago. I was 3 months clean and sober when I went to her funeral. And if anyone knows me and thinks that I am compassionate, empathetic, sympathetic, supportive, a good person, then that is because of my mother. Mm. My father played a part on the work ethic side and being resilient and strong, but all the really good spiritual qualities that I, around care and support and compassion, if any of that that's in me come from my mother. So I want to acknowledge her today and just tell her, if she's looking down on me, I hope she's proud of me and that I love her. So there you go. That's my parting message.
Thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you very much for having me, Jackie.
It would be great if you could support us through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/fabulouslyketo and you can choose the monthly amount you wish.
Can you recommend a guest we can interview? If you can, click on the link in the show notes to send us your recommendation.
Would you like to join our Facebook group? Search for Fabulously Keto on Facebook. Our Facebook page is called Fabulously Keto and you can follow us there. Or you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is Fabulously Keto. Or follow us on Instagram, Fabulously Keto 1. Did you enjoy the show? Let us know you listened by tagging us in your Insta story or Instagram post using the handle Fabulously Keto 1 and the hashtag TFKP. All the links are on the website and in the show notes.
If you haven't subscribed to the podcast, click the subscribe button. Reviews help us to be found and reach new listeners. Please leave a review of our show on your preferred podcast listening platform. We appreciate you taking the time and read them all.
Disclaimer. The information in this podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. Nothing in this podcast can be taken as advice. Whether our guests are doctors, healthcare professionals or not, they're only sharing their own opinions and stories, and this does not constitute a doctor-patient relationship. It's always best to seek professional medical advice should you wish to make any changes to your current medication or treatments. Also speak to your own doctor if you have any concerns about your health or you wish to make lifestyle changes, especially if you're taking medication.